You're listening to Retail Gets Real, brought to you by the National Retail Federation. Join us for a look inside the world's largest and most interesting industry. And now your host, Bill Thorne.
Welcome to another episode of Retail Gets Real, where we talk about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. Today, we have a great program. I'm very, very excited about it, and I know my co-host is. My co-host, my colleague, and my friend, Katie McGreen. Hey, Katie.
Hi, Bill.
How are you?
I'm awesome.
Good. The program today features someone I think a lot of people know already. He's a professor of marketing at NYU, elected World Economic Forum's Global Leaders of Tomorrow, author of a new book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Welcome, Scott Galloway.
Thanks very much, Bill. Thank you, Katie. Nice to be here.
Scott, I'm just going to ask right at the top, tell us about the book.
Sure. So I spend the majority of my time and research, at least bandwidth, focused on Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And I think these four firms have aggregated more power and influence in a modern age than any entities, maybe with the exception of China and the U.S. And what we've effectively done is disarticulated who we are as people and reassembled them in the form of for-profit companies. I think Google is God. It's our new modern super being that provides divine intervention and answers our most complicated queries. Facebook is love, our ability to connect with people, develop empathy, strengthen connections, mostly through images, which are very powerful. I think Amazon is our consumptive self or our gut, taking in nutrition, making sure that we're able to get through the day. And then finally, I think Apple is sex. I think Apple is a signal of your influence, signal of whether you have good genes or not, part of the innovation of the creativity class, and signals your attractiveness to another mate. And I think these four firms have tapped into a very basic instinct, and as a result, have been able to garner extraordinary influence in using things including network technology, globalization, have been able to scale faster than any economic forces in society, and as a result, have a market capitalization that's now greater than the GDP of India. And there's some amazing things. We love these companies. They do amazing things for us. They're great for America on the whole. But there's also some downsides, and we don't talk a lot about those downsides. I think we kind of engage in a gross idolatry of youth and the dollar and the innovation class. So the book is one about looking at the four companies and why they're so immensely powerful, what lessons can be learned to your own business, and then talking about some of the social ills of these firms.
That's incredibly interesting. And I know that you started out many years ago. The older I get, the fewer you want to talk about. But anyway,
that's right.
When you started a new business, you started an online business, you kind of were right out in front of everybody else. What did you see in the internet and the possibilities of the internet that nobody else saw?
So, yeah, I was part of the generation in the 90s that really drank the Kool-Aid and raised about, I don't know, $80 or $100 million for a company called Red Envelope, which was a multi-channel e-commerce company. And it was very, like a lot of people, really, really thought the internet had incredible potential. And if you look at it now, it's sort of the performance has become the promise that it was in the 90s. So if you look at the internet now, it's about, the marketplace is about 200 times the size it was when I started Red Envelope, and the cost of a company to cost to build a website is about 1/20. So technically, you know, the ROI on e-commerce right now from a market size standpoint, not a margin standpoint, is literally 10,000 times greater than what it was. I initially started a company called Aardvark, which was a pet supplies company based on the notion I had a dog, and I thought there's nowhere cool to buy great stuff for your dog, so I thought I'm going to start the Williams-Sonoma Pet Supplies. And we were selling about $10,000 or $12,000 a month in online pet supplies, which made us one of the 50 largest e-commerce companies in the world in 1996. To just give you a sense of how little e-commerce transactions were actually taking place online, Amazon hadn't really taken off yet. There was a place, the only place you could sort of safely buy stuff. And here's a trivia question, Bill and Katie. Do you remember who was selling the most stuff? And it wasn't Amazon. Do you remember who it was? They had a marketplace. This is how long ago. This is kind of internet history. AOL.
Oh, yeah.
AOL had something called a marketplace because no one would put their credit card on the web. They thought a Ukrainian gang was going to take it and buy weapons with it or something. And no one trusted putting their credit card on the internet. So we went to this safe, closed system called AOL that was friendly. And you have mail. And that's where we kind of first started. And you had to put your brands on AOL if you wanted presence. But yeah, did Aardvark sold it? made some decent money there. I thought, wow, I'm good at this. Was graduate of Berkeley MBA, the 90s, in my early 30s, shaved head. I was just optimized to raise a lot of money and went and raised a bunch of money for a Red Envelope and was off to the races. And slowly but surely started to see just how incredibly difficult e-commerce is. You know, there really aren't. It's very hard to find very many successful pure play e-commerce companies. You have one enormous player sucking all the oxygen out of the room, Amazon. And consumers don't live in isolation of any one medium. And the profitability of online commerce, because of the transparency and ease of switching back and forth between sites and comparison shopping, kind of starches out all the margins. So it's, in some ways, it's been the most exciting channel for consumers. It's been the least forgiving for businesses.
I can see that.
I think that's a really interesting sort of frame to think about the current state of retail. And, you know, we're in the business and we talk about it every day. And, you know, there's the headlines of the retail apocalypse and retail is dying. And a lot of that centers around this idea of the death of the store. Mm-hmm. And I know you're not really on that bandwagon. And you talk specifically about what Apple has done. Mm-hmm. What can other retailers learn from Apple and the experience that they're creating as they move forward to become relevant or stay relevant in their
sure.
businesses?
So yeah, the rumors of the death of the store are greatly exaggerated. And we're going through this rationalization based on just basic supply and demand. And that is in the US, what is it, 3x the amount of square footage per capita is Britain, 50% more than Canada. So we just have too many stores. But people have conflated that with this notion that somehow the store is obsolete. And that's just not true. You have some very successful concepts, whether it's an Ulta or a Sephora or a Warby Parker. There really isn't, you know, I work with a lot of e-commerce companies, and the moment they get to center, any sort of critical mass, one of my first pieces of advice is to open a store. So you're going to see rationalization of square footage, but you're probably going to see more costs or more investment per square foot in the ones that survive, because consumers are no longer going to stores for product, they're going for people. Specifically, they want either a person who can get them to the right product and get them out as quickly as possible, because there's nothing more efficient in terms of fulfillment than walking to a store in your neighborhood, picking something up and taking it home. It just, maybe you don't have a doorman, you don't want to sign for it. The packaging, the unpacking, all the echo nightmare that happens when you get something via e-commerce. So stores as a fulfillment network are still remarkably efficient. So they want someone to get them in and out of the store, or they want expertise. They want someone, I bought a Nintendo 3DS for my son who turned 10, and I just had no idea. You know, buying the wrong one is faces a penalty worse than death. An upset 10-year-old on his birthday is just, you know, mom's not happy, everyone. There's a million ways to screw up buying a video game for your kid. So you want to get it right. And if it means going into Best Buy and paying a little bit more, and Best Buy says they'll match any price, which gives you some security on price. But if it means going in and even paying a little bit more, it's worth it, because I need that expertise and that comfort. So I believe one of the hallmarks of successful retailers the last few years, whether it's Sephora and their cast, Home Depot and their golden aprons, Best Buy and their blue shirts, is an investment in what I would coin organic intelligence. While everyone's trying to figure out artificial intelligence to take humans out of the process, I think the opportunity for traditional retailers is to invest in their workforce and make shopping a great experience. And then, to your point, Katie, the experience, you go into Sephora, it's an experience. It really is, it feels different. The buzz and the hipness of a Warby Parker feels kind of modern and makes you feel just, you know, downright youthful, right? Starbucks, just the smell and the employees that are happier is an experience. And the fact that you can sit on a nice couch and not have to leave. And Starbucks, you know, I see one of you has Starbucks on the table right now, I think it's Bill's. They really are the original gangster here, because what they decided was they were going to make a huge investment in their human capital. And Starbucks now spends more money on benefits than they spend on coffee beans. And it's one of those things you don't notice, but it's noticeable when you think about it. And that is, the employees of Starbucks are better. They're happier. They're in a better mood. The vibe is better in there. And it's somebody who just seems genuinely like, I'm working my ass off. I'm making a decent living. I'm working for a company I like and an environment I like. And that isn't true in a lot of retail places. You go in and sometimes it feels kind of, it doesn't feel great. So Starbucks adopted this a long time ago, trying to make taking money out of typical marketing and put it into, quote unquote, the experience.
You talk about talent here with, you know, the folks in Starbucks and the people who are creating the reason for customers to go into stores. And talent is something that obviously retailers care a lot about. And you teach some really talented MBA students. Mm-hmm. I think one of the challenges that retailers are facing is how do we attract great talent?
Yeah.
Not just in the stores and the folks that are interacting with customers, but in the more technologically savvy jobs. You know, how are you going to convince your MBA yeah. students that they should go into retail?
I think it's the biggest issue in corporate America. And in a digital age, the team with the best players wins. I just know when I've started nine companies, and I just know going into a year where we've made a bunch of good hires and we have good people working hard and committed, I just know it's going to be a good year. And then there's other years where we've lost some good people, and I look around and think the talent pool is not that great and the culture is not great. I'm like, this just isn't going to work. So your ability to recruit the best and brightest is kind of the game, full stop. And I think actually Google's done probably a better job of this than anyone. Well, I think that Google has the greatest concentration of IQ on the planet right now, greater than NASA, greater than the government. So the question of, well, how do we attract these people? And there's no silver bullet. You got to offer, I think the opportunity, and this is going to sound politically correct, but there's some substance here. Every CEO of every company I've ever started is either a woman or a member of the LGBT community. Offering flexibility to the female workforce. 70% of high school valedictorians are females. Our workforce is looking increasingly female, increasingly people of color, and trying to understand their unique needs, whether it's letting them work from home for a day or what have you. The other is just throwing money at them. And let's be honest, it works. Google, Facebook, Amazon throw money at these kids. And old economy companies probably have to get used to the fact that they're going to end up in this funky situation where in some instances the people they hire are making more money than the people that have been there 5 years. And people freak out and they say they can't do it. Okay, I understand it causes a culture shift, but there's just no getting around it. If you want to hire the best and brightest and the best schools, you have to give them you can give them some flexibility, some psychological compensation, et cetera, but you got to pay them well. And most companies, old economy companies, talk a big game about recruiting the best and brightest, but don't want to make that sort of investment. This stuff's expensive. These kids, there's just no getting around it. The best and brightest and the best schools are super expensive. And then trying to figure out retention, one of the things I complain about, I mean, I'm older than you, Katie, but Bill, you and I look over the same generation. These kids want and get constant feedback. They see their career as an organism that needs to be kept alive and managed and catered to. And my first job was at Morgan Stanley, actually just down the street here in LA. And the thought of going into my boss's office and saying, you know, I'd love to have a discussion around my career, it would have been a very short conversation. It would have been something along the lines of work your ass off, get back, you know, talk over, get back to work. I got one piece of coaching a year at Morgan Stanley, and it was in the form of a bonus check, and that was it. And I could read into it whatever I wanted, but that was my feedback. And now this generation really wants their career managed, and they respond to it, though. If you take a vested interest in their success, I believe in every company, in my companies, every week, at least once a week, you got to get in front of them and reinforce the vision and talk about why it's a good place to work. And then on a regular basis, sit down with the individuals and say, you know, as a leader of the company, this is my plan for the company the next 2 or 3 years. This is what it means in terms of shareholder value. This is what it means in terms of opportunity. And this is what it means in terms of you. I think this is the opportunities, the roles, and the compensation that will be made available to you. Does this fit to your needs? And what I always tell kids in my company is, I believe in winners and losers. I have a minority of kids at my, I call them kids because they're all so young. I'll take them to a room and I say, you're a superstar here. And I want things to work really well for you here because it's going to work really well for me if I can keep you here. So what I ask is the following. Are you happy? This is what I have planned for you. I'm going to promote you faster than other people. You're going to make more money than other people here. I do believe in winners and losers at work. But I want you to tell me when you're not happy. What I don't want is a surprise. I don't want to find out you've left. I don't want the HR director to come in and tell me that you're leaving. So I want to know. I want an early warning system. But your ability to attract and retain the best talent is the issue. And it is so hard. We look, and I'll stop ranting in a minute, but we look at WPP, IPG, and the traditional marketers. They're losing literally thousands of people to Google and Facebook. And if you look at the reverse migration back, it's a trickle. And then we did an analysis of all the people who went from Google and Facebook to traditional media companies. and something like 40% of them had the term ambassador or intern in their titles at Google or Facebook, meaning they were the people who went to Facebook for the summer and didn't get an offer. Those are the people that then go to the agencies. So who's populating traditional media firms right now? The leftovers.
That's amazing. You know, we Matt Shea, who's our president and CEO, and I went out to Silicon Valley a couple of years ago, met with several of the online retailers, and their biggest thing that kept them awake at night was attracting the talent. Oh, the competition was just so great. So they're getting these 21-year-old right out of school and paying them $210,000.
That's a lot.
And then, yeah.
Even
but,
for the Valley, that's
but,
a lot.
But then, if they're really good, they're there for a year, year and a half, it's recognized, and they move on to the Googles or to the Amazons or to somebody else that can give them even a greater career path and even more money. And it's just, it gets ridiculous.
Yeah, and this is, I think there is a little bit of a bubble because you know, to attract these kids, I'd say, I joke, we have to turn our workforce, our environment into Xanadu, right? Everyone's got to be able to bring their dog and drink and have fun and do things. And that's, you know, there's some good to that, but I think also think there's some bad to it. But the nice thing about retail does have an advantage, and that is some people are cursed with having to be in retail. They wake up at the age of six and they start reorganizing mom or dad's closet. They want to hang out in stores. You know those people. It's like, we all know people who had to be doctors. The people I know are doctors don't know anything. You know, they didn't go into medicine because of the Affordable Care Act, or they didn't go in because they thought reimbursements were going to go up and it was going to be a great way to make a living as an orthopedic surgeon. There are these people that started, you know, playing doctor when they were eight, and it's their whole lives. They're like, I'm going to be a doctor.
I live with one of those.
Yeah, you live with one of those. They're cursed to be
a
doctor.
It is a curse, and their wives are cursed as well.
Yeah,
it's rough.
This sounds like therapy, but I'm cursed.
Get to it.
I'm cursed to be an entrepreneur. I don't have the skill set to work for a big company or for other people. So people say, oh, somehow they romanticize entrepreneurship and think I'm so talented I needed to start my own company. It's not that. It's just I didn't have the skill set to work for someone else. There's some people who are born to be in retail and merchandising, love product, love fashion, love jewelry, love the voice, love merchandising, live to figure out the right toaster that should go on Williams-Sonoma and that it's dual-lit. So there are some people who are just cursed with being in retail because it's a difficult business, but you guys do have a steady pipeline of people that love it. Well, you have to outline for them, and some firms do an amazing job. Starbucks, Macy's, Nordstrom, they build really great careers for young people and they invest in them. Williams-Sonoma, Sephora Division of LVMH, Home Depot. These guys do a fantastic job, Best Buy, investing in their human capital and laying out a path that says, this is going to be a great place for you. We're going to build economic security for you and your family, and you're going to enjoy what you do.
You know, we're running short on time. I could do this for an hour or more. It's incredibly interesting, and especially when you speak about the passion people need to have if they want to be in retail, because it is a lot of work. You lose a lot of friends because, you know, it's all-consuming, and especially if you're starting a business and you're trying to get it up and running, you have the responsibility of employees, and you're trying to get the mix right and everything else. We actually did talk to a successful businesswoman yesterday who said that when she started her business, it really became her focus, and she prioritized her family, the business, and she lost a lot of friends along the way. And she said, sad, but you've got to make that commitment. So anyway, but I do have this question for you. So widely accepted, you predicted Amazon, Whole Foods. Look in the crystal ball. What's the next big thing?
So I don't think it's going to be an acquisition. So as it relates to Amazon, the logical acquisition would be Nordstrom's, but I don't think it's going to happen. They're going private, and Nordstrom is a family-run company, and decisions are irrational at a family-run company. Decisions are made around the dinner table, not, you know, shareholder, not board meetings. So, but Amazon now has license to go into the wealthiest refrigerators. What they need is license to go into the wealthiest closets, because the one place they've had a difficult time is in luxury and aspirational beauty, because the luxury brands and the prestige beauty brands, for very valid reasons, are very uncomfortable partnering with Amazon. I use the term partnering loosely. So if they had acquired Nordstrom, they would have overnight had access to kind of the best brands in apparel, fashion, and beauty. What I think the next big thing out of Amazon is, I think, and I don't know this, they haven't asked me, but if I were running strategy for Amazon, I would launch a program or a pilot called Prime Squared, for lack of a better term, that would say, okay, hey, we have your purchase history. You love Amazon. You're in a house. Everyone's got a smartphone. We're going to outfit it with 6 or 8 Alexas that will be voice sensitive wherever you are in the house. And 2-3 times a week, we're going to send you 3 boxes of the stuff we think you want. We think we understand you really well using artificial intelligence and your purchase history and the kind of brands we think you like. And we can even do reverse depends of your credit card to see what you're buying in stores that aren't Amazon and figure out what you like. And then we'll have an empty box. Put the stuff you don't want back in the empty box. And then use Alexa to calibrate. Alexa, a birthday party for 12 5-year-olds. Alexa, leaving town for 2 weeks. Alexa, Stella Artois, not Peroni beer. Alexa, organic beef. Or Alexa, more pork, less red meat. You know, whatever you might say, you can start calibrating. Alexa, 5 quotes for auto insurance for 2015 BMW 3 Series via email. And you'll be able to calibrate very easily using voice. And pretty soon, I believe they could announce that they've taken these Prime Squared households from $1,300 a year, which is what Prime households do, to $7,000. And basically, all of retail loses 10 or 20% of its value, and Amazon goes to $1 trillion. And the whole world freaks out because we might be on the cusp of having one retailer. But I think Amazon's in a position, using purchase history, artificial intelligence, a fulfillment network that has a warehouse within 20 miles of 45% of the U.S. population or 80% of the disposable income, to effectively announce or signal, we're the only retailer anyone needs. If you want to go buy a Ferrari, fine, that's fun. If you want to go buy a nice watch, that's fun. If you want to buy a Monoblanox, that's fun. Aspirational, high consideration purchases, you keep to yourself. The tedious, monotonous, low consideration, low value purchases, which is about 90% of retail, we're going to do all of it for you. So I think that's what is quote unquote next from Amazon. And I think it's going to take $500 billion out of the combined market cap of every other retailer and add it to Amazon. I think Amazon's going to be our first $1 trillion retailer or $1 trillion company.
That's a very large crystal ball.
We'll see. Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll see.
You know, we had here in LA at the shop.org event, we had Mark Lori with Walmart. And he said voice is huge. It is a huge priority for that company. And so I think Amazon is currently leading the way, but everybody else, as usual, is trying to catch up because they recognize the importance of that.
Yeah, and what's interesting is people will say Amazon or Walmart. I think the answer is yes. I actually think Walmart's going to do quite well too. And what's interesting, I believe they're actually going after different customer sets. Amazon's going after the affluent households. Walmart's going after everybody else.
Yep. So we're out of time, yet we still have time left for a segment that we call Rapid Fire.
All right,
I'm
going
to ask you a few questions, and you have to just give us the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Katie, start us off.
One word to describe teaching young people.
Inspiring.
East Coast or West Coast?
East Coast.
Should people buy the hard copy or digital version of your book?
Hard copy.
One thing most people don't know about you.
I was the Bruin Bear mascot and graduated from UCLA with a 2.2 GPA.
Yay.
Where it got you now.
2.2 GPA. Mom, listen. Congratulations. Well, I think that about wraps things up. So we'd like to thank you again, Scott,
for your
time. It's incredibly interesting. The book is The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Katie, I want to thank you again for your co-hosting.
It's been fun, as always.
It's been great. And thank you all out there for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. We'll post more information about the topics we discussed today on our website, retailgetsreal.com, where you can also find links to other episodes. Subscribe to the show and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We're also on Google Play and Stitcher. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
You've been listening to Retail Gets Real, brought to you by NRF. For more information about the National Retail Federation, visit us online at nrf.com.